Proud co-sponsor of the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. Racial and social justice activist Ajama Umi will deliver a keynote presentation addressed, Does American Identity Equal White Supremacy? This MLK Observance will also feature a Q&A session, songs, and readings. Again, that's the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by a cartoonist and graphic designer who's been chronicling the unique foibles of statewide politics for over a quarter of a century, from his drawing board in the Willamette Valley town of Eugene, home to the University of Oregon. A collection of his work is out now in book form with a foreword by the legendary Jack Oman. It's called Only in Oregon: 26 Years of Oregon Political Cartoons. Jesse Springer, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
So, Only in Oregon, the book covers a lot of ground. It's something of a time capsule of recent Oregon history.
Absolutely. Yeah, it tells the story, the unique, I would say, story of Oregon's cultural and political history of the last 26 years. And I don't know where else you can necessarily find that kind of narrative put together in one place. And it's kind of also a little bit of a unique way of doing it. Each cartoon is accompanied by sort of a fake newspaper article. And I call that instant context. And I think that's really important for people to understand, because a lot of people feel intimidated by a book of political cartoons, like, well, I haven't been following it, or I don't remember what happened in 1997 or whatever. So I think it's really important for people to understand that they'll have all the context they need in the book to understand what's going on. And in some ways, what I've heard people tell me is that it's sort of a fun history lesson, that you learn about the history of Oregon in a fun way.
When your cartoon career got underway in 1995, Oregon was a very purple state. In the 2000 presidential election, it actually took a couple of days for the state to be called for Al Gore. What a difference a couple of decades makes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it seemed like in the state government, it was a very purple state too. You know, I actually moved to Oregon in 1990. So I believe Barbara Roberts was the governor then. I'm not totally sure. I was just working my way into being more politically aware at that point. But the legislature was controlled by Republicans at that point. And it wasn't until, I think, around the turn of the millennium that the Democrats really started to get really firm control over all the elected state positions, the way that we see it now. But it wasn't always that way, that's for sure.
Yeah, Oregon's last statewide elected Republican was Secretary of State Dennis Richardson, and he died in office in 2019. Moderate and even liberal Republicans were a mainstay of the scene here in Oregon until just recently. We had figures like Governor Tom McCall, who was a trailblazing environmentalist, and Senator Mark Hatfield, who fought to overturn racist laws that had been on the books for generations.
Right, right. Well, and it just seems these days the kind of the middle of the road type of Republican is pretty much of a endangered, almost extinct species at this point, everywhere you go. You know, I'll say Dallas Hurd for it was the first name that comes to mind, dramatically tearing off his mask in the state legislature and refusing to put it back on and forcing Senate President Peter Courtney to kick him out. That just happened a few weeks ago.
And then let's see, who was it? One of the state legislators did a very weird, sneaky display of letting Proud Boys into the Capitol through a back door.
Mike Nierman, was that his name? Yeah, he did that. And then there was also during the infamous, well, there's been a couple now, the first walkout that the Republicans did to deny the supermajority Democrats a quorum in order to pass a climate bill, Brian Boquist, they left the Capitol, and then he said something like, come well armed and send bachelors if they want to come drag me back to the Capitol. So, you know, some pretty honestly violent rhetoric coming from the political side of our society, which is becoming unfortunately more and more commonplace.
Well, there's long been a sense of small L libertarianism in Oregon, not to be confused with the capital L Libertarian Party. Wherever people might be on the political spectrum in Oregon, they resent when government or corporations stick their noses into their personal affairs. So in cities like Portland, you get anti-surveillance laws, you get librarians fighting the Patriot Act. In rural areas, you get anti-vaxxers and homeschoolers and public services stretched really thin, which has been the subject of a number of your cartoons.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And public service is stretched really thin. And there's this always this tension between wanting to have some sort of level of government services and a willingness or an acknowledgement that it needs to be paid for. So that's one piece. Another piece is people at, say, the middle and the lower end of the economic scale who are voting against having public services, even though they would probably stand to get more in return in the form of services than they would actually have to pay in the form of taxes. It's a very strange phenomenon. I'm actually reading a really interesting book by a woman named Heather McGee. It's called The Sum of Us. And her analysis is that there's racism involved. And it's this idea that people of color will get something they don't deserve if I vote for these taxes or this government service. So I'm not going to vote for it, even though it would help me. You know, I don't want them to have it. So it's sort of this idea of cutting off your nose to spite your face. It's a very interesting book and an interesting analysis. And I'm fascinated by that right now.
Well, sure. Like the rest of the country, Oregon is getting a lot more diverse than it was even a generation ago.
Yeah. And that's, I hope it continues going even further in that direction.
Political cartooning was for generations a beloved and respected art form. And you point out in the author's note to your book, Only in Oregon, you say, according to the Herb Bloch Foundation, where there were once 2,000 editorial cartoonists grazing the fruited plains of American newspapers, now there are fewer than 40, and the number is shrinking.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was right around the time, you know, the internet broke everything, right? So the internet came along and it totally changed or forced the newspapers to change how they were doing things. And people could get their news for free over the internet, basically. And so Craigslist took over classified ads. And so newspapers, you know, they were struggling, where once they were, you know, fat and happy and they could employ political cartoonists and it was no big deal. But at the time that I was becoming a political cartoonist in the mid-90s and into the 2000s, I had this idea that I would start local and then work my way up and become a nationally syndicated cartoonist and get a job somewhere with a newspaper. But, you know, the tide was going out as I was coming in. And so it became evident. And going to those conferences, those editorial cartoonist conferences in 2006 and 2007, man, there was a dark mood that prevailed. And, you know, people talking about, oh yeah, so-and-so got fired. And, you know, the people were really feeling scared, really, that their profession was disappearing. And so there are still some cartoonists, as we talk about, that are still there. But at that point, for my own self, I knew that trying to attach myself to that business model wasn't going to work. And so that's when I started to realize that what my business model could be was that I would sell cartoons, broadly Oregon cartoons, to papers around the state once a week. And that would kind of compensate me kind of for the time that I spent to put them together. So that was how that whole economic situation impacted my path of being an editorial cartoonist.
Well, the daily newspapers that remain in this country, for the most part, they've all been consolidated into giant corporations. And there's been cost cutting for decades now, even before the internet came in. So the first thing that they get rid of is, you know, are the local people, the local content. And they say, oh, well, we'll just get a cartoonist, you know, that's just doing some anodyne comic from somewhere in the middle of the country, because it's cheaper than getting a local person. And so, yeah, your mentor, Jack Ohman, is one of the few who's still doing local cartoons down in Sacramento. And you're also, you know, part of a dying breed doing local issues as well as national issues.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to speak to that, my cartoons ran for many, many, many years in the Salem newspaper. And, you know, to me, that makes a lot of sense. So many of my cartoons are focused on the legislature and what's going on in the halls of government in Oregon there in Salem. Well, one day I get an email from Vice President of Reader Experience or something like that, based in Nashville, says, we're not going to run your cartoons anymore.
Nashville.
Yeah. And I said, okay, that's too bad. And so I come to find out, because now the Salem paper and the Eugene paper are actually owned by USA Today Group. And so there's some crossover now between the two of them. And so I found out that they only run any letters or editorials once a week. And they've decided that, you know, my cartoon won't be part of that. And I try to push back on that with editors in particular, because it doesn't make any sense to cut away the local stuff, because anybody can get the anodyne cartoon that you talked about. It's freely available on the internet, probably. But what they can't get on the internet is local content. And so what I see on the front page of the Eugene paper is all local stuff. I mean, it used to be way back in the day, you'd have world issues, national issues above the fold on the front page. Now it's all local stuff. And so I kind of make a plea to editors. I say, look, I'm providing you local content. This is what you need. This is what your readers, this is why your readers buy your paper. There's no other reason for them to buy your paper except wanting some local content. So I don't understand why you're cutting my cartoon out of it, because this is the kind of thing that they're looking for.
And as long as papers have been around for at least the last century, the first thing readers turn to, and they say this in the reader polls, is they turn to the cartoons.
Right, right. And now you're talking about the comics pages. It's a little bit of a different animal than what I'm doing, but yes, cartoons, puzzles, sports pages, those types of things. But I believe, you know, that the editorial page is also a place where there's some vibrancy, there's some life, there's difference of opinion, and people are engaging with the topics, and they're stating their opinions, and you also have a columnist who talk about it. And a political cartoon on the editorial page, if you open the editorial page, the first thing you're going to look at is the cartoon, if there's one on the page. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Anyway, you can maybe tell from the way I'm talking that because of the stresses on newspapers, I've had to make my case over and over again. Whenever there's turnover at a newspaper with an editor, I have to remake my case to them that there's value to my cartoon. And they're not expensive, let me tell you. I have set my rates when I first started in the mid-90s, and I have not changed them in 25 years. You know, because I understand that, like, they're cutting costs, and so they're looking for any excuse to cut it out. So I'm not in this for the money, really, although I will say that I do like it to kind of pencil out. I do feel better about that, spending the better part of one day a week working on this. I would like to see it have some remuneration. But anyway, so you can tell from the way I'm talking that I'm constantly needing to make this argument, you know, all the time with editors to keep me on the pages.
Your spouse, Julie, is a middle school science teacher. So the past few years in particular of kitchen table conversations must have provided plenty of material for your cartoons.
Absolutely. And it has given me a unique perspective on the scale and scope of what I can consider to be a massive disinvestment in public education, really since 1990, I believe. I can't remember, ballot measure 5, maybe it was called. It was the first of the property tax limitation ballot measures. And it was followed up by a number of them, kind of clearing up the constitutionality of them and so forth. But It's been really sad to see the state of public schools and how it's a disinvestment, the attrition of staff, inability to have librarians and elective classes for the kids, and larger class sizes. It's very discouraging, actually, to sort of see it from the perspective of someone who's close to me as a teacher. And, you know, obviously, you know, she has her own struggles with it, but it's really what I'm thinking about are the kids that are going through the system and how they're not really getting what I think they deserve in terms of a public education. Back in 2006, I entered a cartoon contest called the Science Idol Cartoon Contest. It was run by the Union of Concerned Scientists, and it was right around the time that American Idol, you know, the singing competition show was on, so that's why they call it Science Idol. And so they solicited cartoons about government interference with science. That's kind of their main focus.
I bet they've got a lot of entries nowadays.
Yeah, you know, there's no shortage on the list of things to look at. And so they solicited cartoons, and somebody told me about this thing, and so I entered it. And they had a series of celebrity judges, one of whom was Gary Trudeau. That was very exciting to me, the creator of Doonesbury. And also Tom Tolles. I don't know if you're familiar with him, political cartoonist. He recently retired. Yeah, he was at the Washington Post for a number of years, and then, yeah, he's retired. And so the grand prize was, I think, maybe like $500, but then they would take you to Washington and you would have lunch with Tom Tolles. And so you could put as many cartoons in as you wanted. So I entered a number of them, and three of my cartoons were in the top 10. And so then they had this voting process. It was basically a popular vote. Like, whoever went on their website and voted for this cartoon would win the grand prize. And so I felt the need to sort of pick which one I thought was going to be the best. And I tell them, all my friends, just vote for this one, because I didn't want to have it be like a split vote. So I told them, you know, vote for cartoon A, don't vote for cartoons B and C. Well, cartoon C ended up winning the grand prize. That shows you how much social network influence I have. And the cartoon, I'll just kind of describe it to you, is sort of like an archaeological dig. And you have a guy kind of like brushing off the dirt on this area that he's excavating, and it says scientist on it. So he's got a lab coat on and stuff. And what he's uncovering is the word truth. And then off to the side, there's this like guy in a suit. He's like the government, and he's shoveling dirt back onto it. And so that was the cartoon that resonated with, I'm guessing, the Union of Concerned Scientists members, because they probably were the ones who did the most voting.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with Jesse Springer. He's the author of Only in Oregon, 26 Years of Oregon Political Cartoons. Well, political cartoons by their nature tend to be pretty critical. So I'm wondering if you've had readers outside the state who think, oh my God, what a consistently negative portrayal of Oregon. Maybe I won't move here after all.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe I'm doing a service then for the state of Oregon. I don't know. Well, I mean, yeah, I think you're right. Political cartoons tend to focus on what's wrong, certainly missteps that political figures have made. So yeah, when everything's happy and shiny, that's the day that the political cartoonist is going like, why me? You know, like, there's nothing to draw a cartoon about. Everything's fine. Yeah, I mean, I guess when that day comes, I'll retire happily.
Yeah, I'm sort of wondering if you get a sense of what people outside the state, what images people outside the state come up with when they think of Oregon. Do you get a sense of that, sort of representing Oregon as you do in your art?
That's an interesting question, because I send my cartoons to family members, for example, who live on the East Coast and friends and stuff. And, you know, the message that I generally get is that a lot of the issues that I address are kind of universal to their area. Like, let's just talk about public education, for example, and taxes and reluctance to pay taxes. State retirement programs all over the country are facing similar issues. And so there's a lot of similarities. Yeah, I mean, I look at some of the unique things about Oregon, and I feel like it's a unique place. I mean, we pioneered a bunch of different things. Like, for example, the vote by mail was an Oregon pioneer thing. We were kind of out in front with death with dignity. So I think that people see Oregon, I think they understand the sort of purple nature of it. They understand there's this real side, you know, like the whole thing with the Bundy takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. You know, they see some of that, and then they also see all this liberal stuff coming out of it too. So I think they do see it as a little bit of a mixed up state in some ways, but complex. Yeah, just kind of coming from all over the place. Whereas other states, you can sort of categorize like, okay, well, we know that Kentucky is going to be this way, and Massachusetts is going to be this way, and all that. But yeah, I get the sense that people feel like Oregon is definitely a real mixed bag of things.
Right. You mentioned the policy firsts. Oregon's been the home to a whole lot of policy firsts. Like you said, Oregon's gone to, it's led the way with physician-assisted suicide, same-sex marriage, vote by mail, the Oregon Health Plan. And that kind of got started in the 1970s with land use planning and the bottle bill and decriminalization of cannabis.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's no way you can deny it. I would say Oregon is definitely a pioneer in a lot of these different ways. And I think I'm excited about the fact that in this state, we're trying to figure out new ways, novel ways, interesting ways, creative ways to solve problems. And hopefully, you know, we can export those solutions to other states. And certainly other states have cottoned on to some of these things. So, you know, I think that's something that Oregonians should be proud of.
Well, another thing that's happened at the University of Oregon over the past couple of decades is that it's almost become a company town for Phil Knight, the founder of Nike. You've got all these buildings on campus now that have the Knight name all over them. And famously, when the students voted to not have their official gear and clothing and such manufactured in sweatshops, Phil Knight came in and overturned that. It just completely went away.
Yeah, for sure. And I have a previous book called Only in Eugene, and I think I have some cartoons that are about that. Yeah, UO President Frommeyer decided to pull out of some agreements with some sweatshops, or actually he decided to align himself with something called the Workers' Rights Consortium, which was monitoring these sweatshops. And as soon as he did that, Phil Knight was like, I'm cutting you off, you know? And so then it was the beginning of a long backpedaling by Frommeyer to sort of get out of that and get back to where they were before. And there is a cartoon that's in Only in Oregon where there's a picture of a couple of guys at a football game, and they're looking down on the field, you know, the logo in the middle of the field, and it has, you know, an O with a big Nike swoosh through it. And the guy's like, yeah, I kind of like that whole duck thing, you know? So it's kind of funny. I mean, they still have the duck, obviously, but so many more swooshes on everything these days than there used to be.
Well, on a similar note about super wealthy people having their way, one thing that Oregon does not have a great track record of is keeping money out of politics. It's one of only five states where there are no limits when it comes to campaign contributions.
It's terrible. It's really terrible. And I would say for many years, campaign contribution reform was one of my big, maybe my top issue, because I kind of feel like if you can't get money out of politics, then how can you address anything else? Like, until you're able to get that influence out of there, how are you going to be able to address any of the other issues? And it's really bad. Voters have voted for campaign finance reform, and the legislature has consistently, I don't know what you want to say, they haven't listened to the voters. Somehow they've managed to not implement the reforms that voters have asked for. And it's still the case. And, you know, this is a situation where I lay the blame. I'm not saying that Republicans wouldn't do it if they were in power, but the Democrats are the ones in power, and they're the ones that are stopping it. So, you know, I need to be truthful. I need to be intellectually honest when I am looking at the issues and the people, and say, these are the people that need to be criticized right now, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or libertarians, liberals, conservatives, whatever. Yeah.
Looking through the book, one of the things I noticed was that you have kind of an old school approach to political cartooning. There's a younger generation of political cartoonists who work in color. They're on the web exclusively. You've still got this kind of newsprint vibe to your mm-hmm. art. It's kind of a pen and ink, brush and ink look with gray tones. And are there certain cartoonists that you really admire from the past that really influenced your look that you said, yeah, this is kind of how I want to work?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. You know, I think Jeff McNally has not been around for a long time, but he was one of the greats whose line I really admire. And what really fascinates me is how to get a stroke that has a real thick and thin character to it. So it gets thick and then it gets thin. And that to me is really expressive. It shows where the artist is. I'm pressing down here and now I'm kind of going lighter. And I don't know, there's something about that conveys kind of an emotional feel that's subliminal, but it's there.
So how would you describe your own artistic style? The word loose comes to mind.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's a good question. I like that you use the word loose, because to me, that means it is conveying the emotion. Whereas if it were tight, like too tight and like a line that didn't have any variation to it, to me, that doesn't put forth any emotion. Or as much emotion, just in the quality of the drawing itself. And there's a lot of different ways. I mean, sometimes what's really fun to do is to come up with a completely different way of doing it. And you talked about that I have, you know, somewhat of a traditional style in my artwork. One of my favorite cartoons, we talked about Brian Boquist, was this kind of fiery Republican senator, Oregon senator, during this walkout in the Oregon legislature. And the cartoon that I did, one of the cartoons that I did in response to that walkout, was in the form of a ransom note. And it was really fun to actually do. And I loved it. I went to the store, I bought a bunch of magazines that had a lot of type on it. And I cut out letters and I used Scotch tape and I taped them. And one of the things I love doing is getting a lot of newsprint on my fingers, so that when I do the tape, you can see like my fingerprints on it, like make it as dirty and messy as possible. And it's something like, you know, if you want to see democracy again, kill HB 2020. That was sort of the ransom note, you know, because they were holding democracy ransom, kidnap democracy, whatever, and holding it for ransom. That was my idea. But I love being able to come up with an idea that's a completely different concept than the normal frame or multi-panel political cartoon.
So you went old school. You collaged a cartoon.
Yes. Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, I had a blast. I had so much fun doing that. I don't know, it's hard to describe. You know, you're just doing a totally different craft almost.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with Jesse Springer, the author of Only in Oregon, 26 Years of Oregon Political Cartoons. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Well, you go to springerdesign.biz, /books, plural. The book is only available on my website, but on the website, there's also a link to a video that I do, like a slideshow of highlights of the book. And so I encourage people, if they're at all interested, is to go to that website and to watch that video, because they'll really get a sense of what's in the book and kind of get an overview, really, of sort of Oregon politics over the last 26 years. So I encourage people to do that as well.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
To the sea, come today, USA, but moment is finally here, with Oregon, Centennial, yeah.
KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.